Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the Business Marketing Club. The BMC is a not-for-profit community network of B2B marketing professionals and people interested in B2B marketing. It's run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers, and we provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, training, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketers. Today, we've got over 1,000 participants across the world. If this is the first time you've joined us, though, you're very, very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. If you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's good to have you along again. In this episode, I'll be speaking to Senior Global Marketing Director at S&P Global Market Intelligence, Amy Stankist, all about retention marketing. Plus, Marketing and PR Director at Stericycle, Andy Johnston, will talk telemarketing. Marketing Director at Clear, Garen Jones, talks about the experience gap. And Client Director at Tribe Communications, Karen Williams, goes and looks at some great business marketing. Lots to like, share and follow here, so let's get started. It used to be said that retention marketing was critical as the most cost-effective means of making sales. In recent years, though, the work of Byron Sharp, among others, has blown that theory out of the water. So what is the role of retention marketing in business today? I'm joined by Senior Global Marketing Director at S&P Global Market Intelligence, Amy Stankist, to tell us. Amy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great that you're here. So before we get started on this topic of retention marketing, though, I'd love you to tell us a bit about S&P Global Marketing and Market Intelligence. What do they do? What are you up to right now?
Yes, so it's very exciting time to be part of S&P Global Market Intelligence. I've been with the company for just over 2 years. We are one division of the larger parent company, which is S&P Global, which many people would be familiar with from, the S&P 500, the S&P ratings agency. So there's many different parts of our business, but I sit in the Market Intelligence division. We are a $2 billion business, and essentially we provide our customers with data, news, information, and analytics that they would need to make better or more informed decisions. So our customers comprise of financial services, governments, large companies across many industries, individuals, and the types of the decisions that we're enabling them to make are things like where to invest next, to maybe help them understand the credit risk rating of a supplier or a customer they might be working with, maybe assessing a new opportunity when it comes to mergers and acquisitions, or it might be just understanding the sort of trends that are happening in the financial markets at any one time. So we're big and broad, and we do help a lot of different types of customers. And it's, like I say, really exciting time to be part of this business. The economy is obviously, with a pandemic in 2020, the economy's gone in all sorts of different directions that nobody expected at the start of this year. So we have a huge amount of demand for our products, our services, and our expertise. So we're having to pivot our kind of service model, the way that we approach customers, that we engage with customers, but we absolutely are always dedicating to provide that exceptional customer experience, whatever the situation, whether we're in a pandemic or not.
It does sound then that you're the person to speak to about retention marketing.
So I kind of
started my introduction with a comment that retention marketing is less important today. Do you agree with that?
I don't. Unfortunately, I don't agree with that.
That's something to talk about, right?
Absolutely. So why? Yeah, it'd be boring if I agreed with everything you said.
So why not?
Well, for us at the moment, and I know it is a strange time in the economy and economies around the world, but growth is an absolute priority for our business. It is number one, everything we're focused on. And growth comes in from two places, from two areas. One is brand new prospects, which, you know, marketing has a lot of influence over, which is great and very exciting when you're going after new prospects and bringing brand new customers on board. But secondly, and most importantly, our current customer base. So growth comes from your current customer base. We're a subscription-based business, or 90% or so subscription-based business. So renewals and multi-year agreements and the renewals of those agreements are so important to our business. And without that, there's no basis for growth. So I would say that retention marketing and retaining those customers and ensuring that we're renewing based on our exceptional levels of service and delivery of our products is so important. I mean, if we start with our customer base, you know, it's our responsibility to really understand what they're going through. So they could be going through all sorts of things right now. And what are their business challenges and their business needs? And then how is our product roadmap and everything that we're developing, how can we best tailor that and package that up to that customer for their specific needs at that time? So we always have the customer at the center of everything we do. And it's not just, you know, with the word retention at the center of it. Obviously, that is a business objective, but we are, you know, there's so much more to that. And it's really thinking about a holistic approach to how you deal with and build relationships with customers much more holistically.
Okay, so how does SMP do retention marketing then?
So there's so many different areas that I could touch on. So again, I've tried to just sort of think about this in a more structured way. So at a sort of grassroots level, a day-to-day level, I would say that we are really trying to be consistent, to be personalized, and to bring a kind of level of exceptional service that our customers will expect from us every day. So what we've done is map out the full customer journey and really analyzed each stage of that. So all of us are very familiar with the same diagram that it's permeated across the organization. Everybody understands what our version of the customer journey looks like and each of those touch points across that customer journey. And at each stage, we've analyzed who's involved in that. So which human beings in our company are involved in that stage and what levels of technology are employed in that as well. So what's the combination of tech and human interaction that makes each stage excellent? Yeah. And I'm not saying we're perfect at this by any means. I don't think anyone could say they are perfect across the customer journey, but we really do look at each stage and figure out what those communications are. So it might be when a customer's first welcomed and onboarded, making sure they've got all the information they need through our communications at their fingertips. So whether that's within the product that they've signed up for, or whether it's the emails that we send them, or any other, you know, much more kind of unique and tailored communications that we might do as maybe part of an account-based engagement or account-based marketing effort. So we would look at that for our, you know, very large customers that we want to put a dedicated team around. But regardless of size of our customers, we want to make sure that we are absolutely giving them that exceptional experience that's frictionless. And this word friction comes up a lot in that whenever you, I think we all as human beings, when you're trying to get anything done, whether that's buying from a company or trying to get help from a company, you want a frictionless experience. You don't want to be held in a queue or to not be able to get in touch with the right person to answer the right question. So the way we look at it is, you know, from technology, which could be deploying chatbots to answer the simplest of questions in an instant, versus having human beings 24/7 on call around the world available at the, you know, the end of the phone to answer much more technical and complex questions. So there's all sorts of different elements that go into it, but you've got to think about that whole journey and each stage of that.
Okay. So what's the result of doing that for SMP?
So we do actually have very successful retention renewal rates. I'm very happy to say our customers are broadly very happy, it seems. There's always more we can be doing, really. And, you know, a lot of people claim to be customer focused, but we really do put the customer at the center of everything. And I think that's really showcased in our renewal success and our loyalty that the customers show to us as well.
And how think about kind of how other businesses might try and learn from your experience. How can they apply frictionless in their business?
Well, again, it's going back to that journey. And when you think about onboarding, when you think about welcoming a new customer, then you think about their day-to-day. So what are all the things that they might be, what are all the touch points they might be trying to progress with your company? What are those interactions that they really want with your company? And at every single point, how are you making it as easy as possible for them? And that's on the sort of day-to-day level. And whether that's through, you know, making sure that the product user experience is great, so that if there's something they need help with, is it super intuitive to get that help? If they're in the product and they're looking at a certain piece of content or from in our product, it would be, you know, a certain data set. How are you serving up things that are similar? It's, you know, I think we all talk about it a lot, but this sort of Amazon experience or the Netflix experience where you're being served up content and experiences that are based on your behaviors. So we're really trying to drill down much more into kind of customer usage patterns and then really tailor a kind of behavior-based or trigger-based approach to our marketing and our communications that is very much kind of what they would expect next, rather than just sending a random piece of communication about something that's totally unexpected and almost disrupts their day and causes that friction. It's very much about this fits into whatever they were trying to achieve in that journey that they were already on, and it adds an extra level of value to them at that time. So again, there's sort of lots of things from a day-to-day perspective. And then when I'm thinking sort of over and above the sort of big ticket items that we've also looked at. So we, for the first time ever last year, we put together a customer conference. So that was the first time we really brought a large group of customers together to really delight them. Like, we just gave them this incredible experience. It was in Miami. I mean, mostly our American customers. And it was just this incredible 3-day experience where we were just able to bring our customers together with our own team members, our internal team members that, you know, build those relationships, build on that level of trust, and really help them sort of immerse themselves in our brand and what it means to be S&P Global Market Intelligence, because we do have an extremely strong culture and extremely great kind of ethos, and our people are one of our biggest differentiators, I believe. So putting our people at the forefront and being able to immerse our customers in that was absolutely phenomenal, and the feedback we got from that was incredible. That obviously takes more investment and more time and more energy. It's not a day-to-day, it's a big splash, big, you know, headline item, but there's a mix of these things that you can do to really engage with your customers on every level. But it depends on your strategy and how you want to be looking at, you know, different customer types and different customer sizes. Maybe you might want to tailor the experiences based on their needs and how they want to interact with your company.
There's quite a lot there. So if I'm quite excited by what you've said, is there a point to start?
Yeah, I think it is mapping out that journey. And it sounds a bit boring, but it's just so critical to do that. And when you sit in marketing, I would say at each point of the journey, so many different functions in a business will have a touch point, but really understand from a marketing perspective what you think the customer would expect at that point and what is going to be most helpful for them and what's going to remove the friction. Mm-hmm. So don't bomb, you know, you don't want to sign up as a new customer to a company and get 10 emails that day that are all completely unrelated and confusing, and you don't know where your password is, or you know something's difficult, you don't know how to get help, you can't pick up the phone, there's no chat, you know, all of those things you've got to just think about. So if I was to put myself in this customer's shoes, what would I want? What would be the ideal state for me? And then start to build out that journey from that point, I would say. And that's probably the best place to get started.
That's great advice. Senior Global Marketing Director at S&P Global Market Intelligence, Amy Stankist, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Telemarketing has traditionally been one of the top used forms of business marketing, but that was before the COVID catastrophe and the global recession. I'm joined by Andy Johnston, who is the Director of Marketing and PR EMEA at Stericycle, to look at telemarketing today. Andy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks for inviting me.
It's good to see you. So before we dive into telemarketing, tell us a bit about Stericycle.
Sure. So basically, Stericycle is headquartered in Chicago, Illinois, in the States. It's one of the global leaders in healthcare waste management under the Stericycle brand, but also is a global leader in confidential secure information destruction through the Shreddit brand, which some people may have heard of. So I'm responsible for 14 of the international markets, and we trade in around 17 markets altogether.
Very good. So the recession, I think you'll agree, has led to a lead generation challenge for businesses worldwide. Is there a place, do you think, for telemarketing in the light of COVID?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, Dave. I think there's no question about the premise about recession leading to a lead generation challenge. I think all of us marketeers are heavily focused on the area. Is there a place for telemarketing? Absolutely. And I think my view is that actually it's probably become even more important during this particular time, because every single lead matters. And I think telemarketing is one of the key channels that we can use to ensure that we maximize that lead flow from coming in as a suspect or a prospect right through to an opportunity to a sale. So I think actually my view is there a place? Absolutely. And I think that place is even more important right now. And that could be telemarketing in its broadest sense, from, you know, finding out whether businesses, their employees are working from home or not. Because if you're a B2B service organization where your service relates to inside a company's premises, the first thing you need to do is, are workers working at home or they're working in the office? So there's that element. There's the market research, there's the qualifying of leads. So the whole gambit of telemarketing angles, I think, is increasingly important during COVID-19.
Interesting. So if telemarketing is so important, how should businesses approach it today?
Yeah. So I think from a strategic perspective, when we look at marketing and sales operations, we have to ask ourselves, what is the most effective way of A, going to market, going to generate new acquisition customers, and what channels should we use? And I think many businesses are having to ask, and have probably already asked the question, can you manage with the same level of field sales resource as you did pre-COVID? And can you or should you manage with the same level of inside sales or telemarketing resource? So I think from a strategic point of view, actually, many businesses are probably growing their telemarketing function inside sales and are probably reducing some of that field sales headcount, A, because you can't go knocking on doors, you can't go and visit face-to-face, and obviously from a cost-effectiveness point of view, if you can have an inside sales team who can not only develop the conversations, but sell at a higher level of contract value, I think that's one reason in my mind where telemarketing strategically as part of the overall sales marketing mix is becoming and has become even more important.
So can you give us some examples of businesses that are taking that particular approach of you know, focusing on growing their telemarketing base and reducing their field sales base? And I'm intrigued then to kind of follow that up with, well, what result are they getting?
Yeah, sure. So I'm always quite loath to quote other businesses because they might come back and say what you've just said isn't true or
it's not. Welcome to come on the podcast.
So yeah, absolutely, come on the podcast. But I think, you know, certainly from my perspective and people that I liaise with in the network of marketing network, it's not unique to an individual business or certain types of businesses. I think we are seeing, and there's many statistics out there to show that there is a general reduction in field sales, an increase in inside sales, A, for cost effectiveness, but B, you just can't go out and visit the customers in the same way, in the same way that we used to. So I don't think it's fair to pinpoint individual businesses. I think actually it's becoming more and more standard across many organizations, and particularly depending on the type of product or services that those organizations are selling.
Okay. So what's your advice, Andy, about telemarketing in the channel mix to those marketers who are listening in?
Yeah, I think there's so much that we should be focusing on getting involved in. So I think a couple of things. One is, depending on the organization structure, marketing should be setting the strategy for telemarketing across its different areas. Very, very close working relationship, again, whether that's data related, strategy related. But I think we've also got some of those very practical things, making sure the lead flows are being correctly attributed. The worst thing in the world for a marketeer is seeing a web form come in or a telephone call come in and it's not followed through properly on Salesforce or whatever system. So get close to it. Look at the strategy, devise the strategy, but you've got to get into the weeds. And things like, you know, the data issues, GDPR, the days of just buying in raw data and passing that to telemarketers, that's gone. And I think one of the points is, when you look at the small print on data purchase contracts, those data sellers put all the liability on the user and not the provider. So things like that. But I think, you know, the final comments would be, get excited by it, because I think it's a fantastic channel, a great people working in it. It's a hard job. I've done it myself. I grew up, one of my first marketing roles was teleselling, teleappointing. So enjoy it, appreciate its hard work, but also appreciate its significance and in its rising in significance in terms of the marketing mix. So I think that's where I would say, Dave, in terms of advice for people who are thinking about telemarketing.
That's great advice. Andy Johnson, the Director of Marketing and PR EMEA at Stericycle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you.
There's a gap in experience between a brand promise and customer experience. And that gap has changed in the light of the COVID crisis. So says Geraint Jones, Marketing Director at Clear, who joins me now. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to see you. So first of all, what is Clear?
Oh, okay. So Clear is the global growth consultancy part of M&C Saatchi, and we specialize in brand experience and innovation consulting. We've been around for about 2 decades. I think we founded in 2002. We're about a $20 million business, offices in London, New York, Dayton, Ohio, Frankfurt, Shanghai, Singapore, all around the world, really. And I guess the most important thing to know about Clear is that we believe that clarity creates growth. We use clarity ultimately as a tool to navigate a pathway through the complexities and chaos of the world that we live in. I mean, if that's not valuable in 2020, I don't know what is. But, you know, you've got automation, data overload, the incredible pace of change that was all happening pre-COVID, and then all of the other chaos that has happened in 2020 to add on top. It's been quite the challenging year. So we think clarity is a really powerful tool to help marketing leaders deliver growth in that context.
Okay, so we're talking about an experience gap. Can you tell us about a bit more about the experience gap as you've characterized it?
Yeah, I guess I go back about 3 years, I think now, 2017, our chief strategy officer, a lady called Rhonda Hyatt, and I ended up chatting on a call and talked about this sort of nascent thing that we'd sort of spotted called an experience gap, in effect. And for us, it was very simple, as you characterized it earlier. It's sort of very straightforward. It's the gap between the promises brands are actually making in their communications and the experiences they go on to deliver when the rubber hits the road, I guess. So in 2018, we spent a load of our own money to try and size that gap to, you know, cards on the table, sell more experience consulting work, but also to help brands to understand that this was a commercially challenging thing. It was costing them money, and that the gap existed for everybody. However good or otherwise you felt you were at connecting experience up to brand, there was always some sort of gap to be closed. And for those who were really struggling, it was an incredibly costly gap, because what was happening was that not only was it costing them loyal customers, but it was actually also costing them new customers. So there was cost at both ends of the funnel.
And because this is a business podcast, I've got to ask about B2B versus B2C here. You know, is the gap different, as you characterized it, in the B2B space compared to B2C?
I've had a bit of a think about this. I think they exist in B2B as much as they do in B2C, absolutely. I had an experience, to give you an example, I had an experience not long ago. We did buy a relatively well-known IP tracking tool to help us to understand visitors to our site. And their ABM was fantastic. Really, really good. They were extremely thoughtful, extremely wise to the needs of our specific type of business that came through in every piece of comms we got. They provided us with really interesting insights into the way that we could be using the tool more effectively, all sorts of stuff that should really have helped us stay. And they couldn't help the crisis causing an issue with the baseline of their product. So they were doing everything they could to help us stay. But what was really interesting to me was that I think, and this is typical actually of what's happened during the crisis in a lot of B2B situations, is that the connection that was forming between brilliant ABM teams and their sales teams has started to fray, has started to become less secure. And of course, what I mean by that is that I was getting sales messages on LinkedIn from this company saying, oh, we think you should use our product. And I'm sitting there going, I'm currently using it. And I'm getting 6 or 7 messages from you telling me to use it again. And this is the sort of product that you could very quickly go onto my website to understand whether I'm actually using it. So there was a huge immediate gap opening up. And what it was doing was it's undermining my trust in the tool, in the service, and actually undoing a huge amount of hard work that clearly the ABM team at that business has been doing. So those gaps start to exist, but then they start to open up much more rapidly. And I think in B2B in particular, I think we're less patient and we're less forgiving of brands with which we have a less emotional connection. Where it's a very practical relationship, where it's a tool that fundamentally helps me do my job one way or another. Yes, it has some emotional impact on my life. It kind of helps with certain elements of the hierarchy of needs, but it's not something that I'm going to have any sort of warm and fuzzy feelings towards. And therefore I can be much more rational about the fact that when the gap forms or opens up between the experience that I'm expecting and the experience that I actually get delivered, I'm much more likely to become upset, much more likely to become quicker to pull the trigger to say, I'm going to stop working with this particular business. So I think actually in B2B, it's even more important to worry about experience gaps, and even more important, as Abigail Posner at Google Brand Unit was telling me earlier in the year, to fight hard to keep the humanity and the data together and work them harder together than that perhaps some of the businesses we work with have been able to over the crisis.
How about the COVID lens on all of this? How has the COVID crisis changed the nature of the gap?
So I think I divide it into two distinct phases. I divide it into the phase where everybody and their uncle was going out and creating advertising campaigns above the line that said, we're all in this together and we're here to help you with the same piano track and the same stock imagery or some sort of remix of the equivalent. And I think they, you know, you may have seen Byron Sharp, the great Professor Byron Sharp, come out recently and say, actually, that was probably wasted money, which goes against some of the advice you'd hear from somebody like Les Burnett or Peter Field, saying, you know, actually, it's really important to continue investing in your marketing through a crisis because you get excess share of voice, and as a result, you'll start to climb if your competitors are not investing. So I think for me, there was that first phase where people started to just sort of panic and say, oh, we need to have a message out. And actually what those messages did in terms of experience gaps was actually they created larger gaps rather than closed them, because there was no way that brands would be able to actually prove that they were in it together to the level that they would need to justify to consumers those messages. Having said that, I think very quickly brands became very wise to that need to actually think much more about experience than they were thinking about communications. So I think from that initial slightly poor start, you might argue, I think a lot of brands around the world in lots of different categories, including B2B, became very much better at closing experience gaps at pace. And I'll go back to talking about Abigail again. She mentioned a retailer in the United States who started off with, you know, one of these campaigns, but very quickly started to look at search data to understand the actual live queries that were coming through from consumers and customers to understand exactly how they should adapt their service and their experience on the fly to create, you know, curbside pickup and provide the information about how curbside pickup was working in an easy to find and most used channel. So they started using WhatsApp, which they hadn't used before. So you immediately start to see some really interesting behaviors from brands that I have also seen in B2B, where they've been much more reactive to the specific tactical needs of customers in the very short term. They have been able to leverage technology to allow them to close those gaps much more quickly. And they've been extremely rapid actually to do that. So that was sort of first phase. I think we're now getting into a second phase, which is that there's been a lot of tactical work. There's been a lot of focus, whatever sector you're in, from, you know, from B2B through to charities, through to airlines, through to, you know, food and drink and beverages and retail, there's been a lot of tactical work to try and just commercially stay afloat, which is fine. But on our Clear Conversations series a couple of weeks ago, we were talking to marketers about the fact that, you know, how much are you now looking forward? How much are you thinking about your strategy for 2021 and beyond? And I think a lot of people have recognized that by going very, very tactical and very, very short term and very, very KPI driven, quite a lot of the investment they might have made in saliency and, you know, translating their purpose into something that was valuable to customers has been lost in the chaos. And now there's a need to reestablish the sort of fundamentals of those brands and the distinctiveness of those brands to justify the continued relationship as we move into what will be an extremely tough economic cycle. So I think we're now moving into a situation where there's a need to rebalance from all of this heavy investment in experience, tactics and technology into needing to think about reinvesting in the distinctive elements of your brand that make you stand apart from your competition.
Okay, so there's a gap. It definitely exists in B2B. There's been a flurry of activity around to try to close it. What can businesses do to close the experience gap?
It's an interesting question. I think there's a number of things that businesses can do. I think the first thing that they can and should be doing is thinking about how they position themselves in the market properly. And it sounds like 101, but there are so many that don't. And I think there's been a particular rush in the B2B space to create these really kind of highfalutin and difficult to translate purpose statements that typically are internal, but increasingly are starting to sort of filter through into ad campaigns and the like. And if you have a highfalutin purpose statement, it's very difficult to adhere your experience strongly and tightly to that purpose statement. It's very, very difficult to do. And I'm not sort of suggesting that people should sort of aim low. That's not what I'm talking about at all. But what I am saying is be a little bit more realistic about what's achievable. Because your customers, I think, and we know this from, you know, surveying, you know, nearly 50,000 of them now, customers will give you the credit for having an ambition. They will not give you the credit for being for lacking any common sense ultimately in what's actually achievable. You know, fundamentally, they will believe you if they think actually that's ambitious, but it's just ambitious enough for me to believe in it. But if they think you're being ridiculous, they'll just ignore you, and they will bite back in the sense that they probably won't start to engage with your product. So that's one thing.
So whilst we're on that one thing, can you give me maybe an example of a business that does it well now?
Oh, I'm trying to think of a B2B example. I can give you some very interesting sort of financial services examples, I guess. The most obvious one, and the most brilliant one actually is a brand that we have here in the UK, Ronseal, which is the quick drying wood stain that does exactly what it says on the tin. And it's such a simple example, and you go, oh, it's ridiculous. But it just illustrates that point beautifully, because it literally does exactly what it says, and everybody who buys that product believes it, and it's an incredibly successful product. If you take it out a little bit and become a little bit less comedic, let's say, then you can look at somebody like First Direct, I would say, as a great example. Again, they don't try to promise too much. They don't try to tell you that they're going to change the world with their banking, but they do promise you speed, efficiency, and ultimately a good experience as a customer. And they have unbelievably high customer retention rates, and they have unbelievably high customer satisfaction scores because they deliver what they say they will do. And I think you can see examples where that hasn't worked. And I don't want to name too many names directly here because I don't think it's fair, but you know, there are big ERP solutions providers who promise the earth and are unable to deliver on even a tenth of that promise, who I think they find themselves in this position where people sign multi-year contracts and think, you know what, we only have to get close. We don't even have to get that close for people to stick with us. But the competition is so fierce, particularly as you go into a crisis, that I think anyone who's thinking we can get away with this is sadly mistaken.
Garen Jones, Marketing Director at Clear, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
There's some great business marketing and communications out there, and I'm joined now by Karen Williams, the Client Director at Tribe Communications, to celebrate it. Karen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the invitation.
It's good to see you. So first of all, tell us a bit about Tribe Communications.
So Tribe is an insight and communications agency that puts the audience at the heart of everything that we do. So our communications campaigns always start with getting some really meaningful audience insights and some data that we can use to make sure that what we're doing actually moves the needle on business outcomes for our clients.
So there's some great marketing and communications out there, I think. What's caught your eye?
You know, something that caught my eye towards the end of lockdown and which, you know, amused me and as a marketer really made me think as well, was something from Apple. I don't know whether you saw in 2019, they had a piece of content called The Underdogs, and it was about a marketing team, at that point office-based, who had a challenge that they had to meet. And it's, you know, the storyline of how they use Apple technologies collaboratively to get the job done when they're under enormous pressure. So what Apple did was take advantage of the current situation, and they brought out Underdogs 2, which is a really great video that looks at the consequences of home working and how Apple technologies can help you to keep your business on the rails when we're all being distracted by the kids trying to have their breakfast and chucking cereal around the room, falling over the dog, unexpected phone calls in the middle of meetings and all of that sort of thing. And it's a really, really nice piece about how different generations with different levels of technology competence can pull together on a project that's facilitated by Apple technology. And I just thought it was great because it captured, of course, the spirit of the times when we're all trying to keep our own businesses going when we're distanced from one another. And it was the humour as well, I think, that I really appreciated at a time where there's a lot of doom and gloom around. And, you know, as marketers, we're all clear that, you know, we need to maintain relevance in our communications. I thought, well, that is spot on. That is so relevant because that speaks to each and every one of us in our home offices today.
It is a great piece. It's probably still up on YouTube if you haven't seen it, I suspect. The thing that was going through my mind as you were describing it was, to what extent do you think a sequel was ever actually planned? Is this an example of Apple behaving in a really agile way, you know, of seeing what was going on in the marketplace and then trying to take advantage of it by deploying their kind of more recent marketing in a different way? Or do you think actually there was always a sequel out there?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, they're not like Hollywood producers. The first episode wasn't left on such a cliffhanger that I was expecting a sequel. And, you know, I think it was kind of, it's a wrap after the first one. And who would have foreseen the way the world would change to enable them to do the follow-up in the way that they did? You know, to me, I'm a very basic level Apple user. You know, and my colleague Gareth is much more conversant than I am with all of the different technologies and the design capabilities and everything else. I use mine for surfing the web and for email and all of the basic things like Zoom conversations as we're doing now. And it, as a piece of content, it landed with me because I think it brought home to me that we all need to adapt. We all need to change the way we work. And whatever stage you're at in your career, there is always this potential for learning. And the current situation is forcing us all to develop new skills and to adopt new technologies. So for me, it came along just at the right time. But I'm not sure that anybody in Apple planned it.
Maybe they can come and let me know if they did. What and if you speak of learning, what have you learned from this that you'll apply to your future work?
I think the need to be agile. You know, the need to rather than producing firm plans at the beginning of the year, you know, and I've worked in house, I've been a marketing director, I've had big budgets, and I've planned ad nauseum 12 months in advance, you know, what we're going to do, which channels are we going to use, which pieces of collateral, which events, and so on and so forth. If I were back in-house now, and even working with clients, I think I'd encourage people not to plan to the nth degree, but to be flexible. Of course, it means that, you know, as a team, you've got to be able to make things happen quickly. You've got to be brave. You've got to be bold. You've got to be able to get things signed off and, you know, have the budget for things. But the ability to be reactive fast in the modern world to things that you see happening in the environment, I think is much more important than a lot of us appreciate.
That's great advice. Karen Williams, Client Director at Tribe Communications. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And that's it. That's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Amy Stankist, Andy Johnston, Garen Jones and Karen Williams. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andy Gratian, Alex Horn and Josh Bench. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers. And you can check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.